From the Sky News Centre at 5, an inquest heard a commanding officer killed in Afghanistan insisted on travelling in an exposed position in the lead vehicle for patrol to inspire his men. The coroner ruled Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornlow and 18-year-old Trooper Joshua Hammond were unlawfully killed in an explosion last July. Our defence correspondent Jeff Mead says it was unusual for someone of Thornlow's rank to be in such a potentially dangerous position.
We heard from Major Andrew Speed, Lieutenant Colonel Thornlow, second in command, that Rupert Thornlow was a man who liked to be a team player and to share the risks that they were facing every day.
Florida's governor has declared a state of emergency as an oil slick heads towards the coast. It's already reached the shores of Louisiana, prompting fears of an environmental disaster. BP says it's ready to pay for the cleanup from the spill, which started when a rig exploded. Labour are trying to give their election campaign a much-needed boost by bringing in a familiar face. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair has been visiting Harrow in northwest London in an attempt to win votes. He's rejected suggestions Labour could come third.
I don't believe that will happen. I think that Labour's got every chance of succeeding. But we will succeed best, and I don't think this is much disputed by people, if the focus is on policy. You know, that's where we're strong.
CCTV footage has been released of the moments after a teacher attacked a pupil with a dumbbell. Students are seen running into a corridor to watch science teacher Peter Harvey repeatedly strike the 14-year-old boy. Mr. Harvey was cleared yesterday of attempted murder. Unite says it will announce the result of the ballot of BA cabin crew next Friday, the day after the election. The union is recommending that 12,000 staff reject the latest settlement offer. She may have just been named the sexiest woman in the world by FHM, but Cheryl Coles described herself as a bit skanky. In a magazine interview, she says she loves lazing around in her pyjamas. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guests to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world. In the last programme before the general election, are Labour's deputy leader on Bristol City Council, Mark Bradshaw, and Liberal Democrat cabinet member and prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol East, Mike Popham. Last week we had the Conservatives and the Greens. This week it's the two parties who have been getting the most votes in Bristol over the last few years. That's the Lib Dem and Labour, to battle it out. After the 6 o'clock news, Bristol's leadership debate last week. Why was there virtually no audience involvement? After all, as Brown, Clegg and Cameron kept telling us, we run the show, apparently. And old Labour economist Martin Summers will be here delving into the murky world of computerised stock dealing software, how a computer program designed to save the free market turned into a monster. And we stick with analysis of Goldman Sachs, close friends of the IMF, as we look at the Greek financial crisis. Could it be a financial virus and bring down the euro? Plus, BCFM's arts correspondent Billy Quain will be here with his top tips for where most productively to loiter over the next week. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, including Bank Holiday Monday, averaging 10 degrees Celsius in the daytime. Generally cloudy, with some rain on Saturday morning, that's tomorrow morning and evening, and on Sunday morning. Averaging 11 degrees Celsius next week, a dryish week with some sunny spells, especially on Tuesday. And next weekend, that's the 8th and 9th of May, temperatures again around 10 degrees Celsius in the daytime, dry with plenty of sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and joining us is Labour's deputy leader on Bristol City Council, Mark Bradshaw. Welcome to Drive Time, Mark.
Thanks very much, Tony.
Now, by way of introduction, are you from Bristol?
No, but I've lived in Bristol for nearly 10 years now.
Okay, what have you given to this city through your service on the council?
I've been a councillor now for four years. During that time, I held the transport brief, amongst other things, which was quite an entertaining, interesting time. But my main focus has been as a councillor for Bedminster. I've done a lot of casework, a lot of improvements around Bedminster. That's been my main focus. I think if you look at any member of council, your first and main job is as a councillor for the area that you represent.
Okay, we're also joined by Mike Popham, who's a Liberal Democrat cabinet member on Bristol City Council and also prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol East. Now, Mike, what about you? Are you from Bristol?
Hello, Tony. I was born and bred in Glastonbury.
Now, what about what you've given to the city through your service on the council?
Well, I was elected in 2007 to Clifton East, lots of casework for the ward. Certainly concerned about the effective waste collection that we have. It's getting better all the time now, but it wasn't good when I started. I shadowed housing, quite a tough task as any councillor would find, because you've got the oversight to carry out without any support. But then when we took control last year, I became the cabinet member for efficiency and value for money, and that's essentially a cross portfolio role, which is tough within itself, but with the primary responsibility for leading on transformation.
Okay, thanks both of you. Now I'm going to propose some policies, and I'd like you both to tell me briefly, and I mean briefly, like no more than 30 seconds, whereabouts you stand. First of all, you maybe you'd like to go first on these, Mark, and you second, Mike. Mm-hmm. Mark, if you were Chancellor now, what would you do to fix the economy?
Well, we've said that we'll cut the deficit over the next 4 years by half, but we will protect spending on the health service, on schools and education, and on the police. Those are the right priorities, and we've got to keep investing in those, not taking money out of the economy now, which would risk us going back into recession.
Mike, what about you?
Well, I'm particularly disappointed that the majority debate in this area is about tax and spend. The third essential pillar in all that is how to earn our keep internationally. The more we earn internationally, the more we can afford to live better in this country. We need emphasis on that. We need to readdress our image in the world after the Iraq War, start to trade with all countries and do better for the economy.
Now, what about immigration? Mark, you first. Should we be allowing Europeans to work here, forcing down paying conditions when we already have so many unemployed?
Well, we're in the European Union, and I think there's about 1 million European Union workers in the UK. There's about 1 million Britons who work elsewhere in the EU, and it's always been part of our membership of the EU that there's freedom of movement of people, skills and jobs. Of course, we've now introduced a point scheme, like Australia, where only those people who have skills that we need and qualifications that we need will be able to come into the UK. What the Conservatives are seeking to impose is a cap, an arbitrary cap, but they've forgotten about those people who live in the EU who are already entitled to live and work here. So it's a bit of a false issue that the Conservatives are now putting across. But okay, we've always encouraged
you
people.
You've had your 30 seconds there. Now it's Mike's turn.
Yeah, I largely support what Mark has said, actually. I fully support the free movement of people going about their business professionally worldwide. There are as many people who go out as come in to work. The issue I've got is who is in this country supposedly working? Are they working? Do we know where they are? Are they operating legally or illegally? And it's the Liberal Democrats' contention that there are a large body of people in the country who we don't know about. What are they doing? What do we do about them? How do we find them?
Okay, fine. Okay, the next question for you first, Mark, for Labour. Has the nationalisation of utilities, public transport, etc., been a success?
Well, I would like to think that...
the privatisation. What did I said? Yeah, no. Nationalisation, didn't I?
Well, we've got the Tories to thank for the privatisation of buses and rail back in the 1980s.
And Labour has been trying to privatise the post office.
Well, no. What we've said is that there needs to be a new settlement for the post office, which means that it is able to compete, because it is a very competitive market for post. But in terms of transport, I think most people agree that to nationalise rail and buses would just be massively expensive. It's something that we can't afford. What we've got to do, particularly as a city, is make use of the new powers to control fares and for frequencies and other things.
Okay, Mike.
Yeah, again, I'm largely...
For the Liberals, just to remind people.
Yeah, sure. I largely support what Mark has said. I don't think we can go back now to nationalising, for example, the bus services. But most certainly what we need to do is take more control of them. And however we do that, I'm not sure. We've got to take control.
OK, another financial question now for you first for Labour, Mark. Should the Treasury be using our shares to force the banks to lend?
Yes, and that's why we've set up an ombudsman, so that if you're a small business and you feel that the bank isn't lending to you and you feel that you've got a good case, you can go to this third-party arbitration. This is a new scheme that we have set up. You know, now that the state owns most of the banks in our country, we've really got to force them to lend. And we've got to move away from this high-risk lending that they've done in the past. So it's lending to small firms in particular who need that financial help.
OK, Mike, for the Lib Dems?
Yeah, I think the government are actually in a position of negotiation with the banks. It seems to me, from what I can hear, that the threat from the Treasury is to regulate them unless they fall into line. What disappoints me is that every day that goes by about money flow through a small business is absolutely critical and sometimes frightening, whereas the banks don't suffer those day-by-day pressures.
OK, now I'm going to ask you both about rising crime and slow police response times, because we covered a story a couple of months ago here about Avon and Somerset Police being one of the slowest 999 response times. So, Mark, would you like to start on that topic, rising crime and slow police response times? What's the Labour Party up to?
Well, I think the latest figures show that violent crime in particular has dropped to an all-time low, but the fear of crime is still high, and that's why we've invested in more police. That's why we've got more PCSOs on the street. I think when Labour was in charge of the council, we funded a further 40 PCSOs in the city. About the response times, you know, it's up to Avon and Somerset to actually improve. What we've said in our manifesto is those police forces that don't improve can be taken over by neighbouring forces that are actually much more effective, much more successful, and that's something that we're very keen to do.
Okay, Mike, what's the Lib Dems' view on how to tackle rising crime and slow police response times?
Yeah, I think putting one force against another essentially is backing off from the real issue. We need to find out exactly why the response times are low. For example, are there too many uniformed police officers working back office on analytical tasks, admin tasks, that sort of thing? If there are, they should be replaced by non-uniformed staff or civilians, or indeed retired police officers coming back in to help out. But either way, response times improve when we've got sufficient resources to respond.
Now, many of our troops, the next question, are coming back after their four-year service in the British Army and finding themselves homeless because they don't always have, they're not always able to find somewhere to live. What would you do to address this problem, Mark, as a Labour candidate?
Well, we've increased the funding to improved armed forces homes because it was wrong that the forces and their families had to live in homes that were often not up to decent standards. So we're investing, I think, 20 million plus per year to actually improve those. You know, these are people who have risked their lives for Britain in some of the most dangerous circumstances. It is right that they should have a roof over their heads when they get back to the country. It is also right that they should have as much help as possible in terms of skills and jobs if they leave the armed services. You know, that has always been the contract and understanding that the government has had with people who risk their lives for the country.
So, Mike, for the Lib Dems, what would the Lib Dems do to help troops who are leaving the army and then finding themselves homeless?
Yeah, well, I served for 20 years in the Royal Air Force, and I was made homeless at one stage with a family. So I know what it's like. It only happened for a short period. But clearly, the MOD has to start to manage the movement of people and their families ahead of the change that they're implying, that they're forcing upon those families.
Okay, and staying with housing, what about council housing? We've seen the first few council houses in Bristol being planned. Mark, what's the Labour Party's policy on council housing? Because it's been over 10 years till the Labour Party have actually decided, right, we're going to build some council houses.
Well, we're very pleased that Bristol has received this funding from the Labour government because it has been, as you say, a long time. But what we've also been trying to do is to make it easier for local authorities to A, build more council housing, but B, find alternatives like the cooperative approach to make it easier for people to actually build and then own their own homes, or to find some other way of finding affordable housing. Lots of different approaches to this. I think what we don't want to see are the massive estates that were built in the 1960s and 1970s, which all governments built. I think the Conservatives were actually building the first mass council housing. What we want is mixed estates where people live together, both owning and indeed renting their own homes.
Okay, Mike, what's the Lib Dems' position on council housing? Are they going to be instituting a big council house building programme if they get at least some share of power in Westminster?
Well, we need.
Are they?
Yeah. Well, yes, we need sufficient housing for the nation, irrespective of people's status. So there should never be a gap in availability of housing. What we have in Bristol now, following the credit crunch, is a lot of flats standing idle. I would like to see those brought into public ownership, where they cannot be sold on the private market, so there is sufficient housing for everybody.
And what about Afghanistan? We mentioned the army as well just now, but what are both of your views on the continued occupation of Afghanistan and moves to campaigners, anyway, to get troops out of Afghanistan? Mark, for Labour.
I think our involvement in Afghanistan is because of the threat that many of the terrorist plots were directly linked to Afghanistan and to the Taliban. And, you know, I'm quite clear that the quality of life in Afghanistan, whilst it is not, you know, where it should be now, is certainly improved to when the Taliban were in charge. You look at the quality of education now, you look at the fact that women can now play an active part in Afghan life, whereas one under the Taliban, they were just sidelined. So I think that there are a whole range of issues to be gone through, not least making sure that the Afghan army and police can safeguard the security of the country, and then we can bring our troops home.
Mike, for the Lib Dems, what's the Lib Dem position on Afghanistan? Would they consider bringing the troops home?
Well, we're there by invitation, so I presume that the government in Afghanistan believes we're useful to that country doing what we're doing. We're not invaders, we were invited in. We should continue to fight terrorism. It's today's big issue. But we must not only do it by military force, we should do it by politics too.
Okay, and we touched on it briefly again earlier on, but post office closures, I mean, this has been affected people a great deal, and I think for many people they will remember, oh yes, this was Gordon Brown that closed down post offices. What's your policy on post offices at the moment then, Mark, for Labour?
Well, what we need to do is to secure the long-term future of the post office, and that means that it needs to be on a better basis to compete. It also needs to do something about the gap in its pension fund, which is, you know, way too big. You know, I'm in no doubt that the post office is an important part of our local fabric, and it's important that we find ways of keeping post offices open. You know, I'm certainly campaigning in my own ward to try and get post offices back, and we need to find new ways of actually doing that. You know, maybe linked to libraries and health centres and larger stores, but we've got to find a way to actually do this. Many people depend on the post office. Not everything can be done online, so there is still a need for them.
What's the Lib Dem position, Mike, on this?
Well, we never wanted to see the devastation in the post office network that we've seen. But clearly, if we go back 13 years, not to be too political, but I think there was a thorough misunderstanding about how to operate an enterprise such as a post office network. And if they'd adopted formalised business skills to work out the best ways to allow it to thrive, taking full note of the value it has to the community, then it may not have got to this point. So we ought to actually stop closing them now, pause, and work out exactly what to do to make them thrive.
Okay, and finally on this quickfire policy section, potholes. Mark, this is something that's we had severe weather in the winter, but it still seems that many of our roads, including A roads as well as the little local roads, are full of potholes. It's almost like a third world country.
Mm. Well, the Chancellor gave more money to local authorities in the budget to repair potholes. I think in Bristol there are still a lot which haven't been dealt with. I know in my own ward I've got a number that I'm asking the council to sort. But I think that the bad weather has caused, you know, quite a lot of damage to road surfaces and to pavements, and it will take a while to actually put them right. But what I want to see in the city is a more systematic approach to maintaining roads and pavements. It's something that we don't seem to currently have.
So, Mike, how's the Lib Dems going to deal with the potholes?
Well, there's no doubt this damage was caused by the bad protracted weather. I'd like to see a different way of repairing the roads, actually. There are machines around that do it much, much more quickly and very much more cheaply. John Rogers, our executive member for Transport, is well aware of that revised method of repairing potholes, and I do hope that we can transfer to that form of repair.
Right, thanks very much for that, folks. Now, we're going to have a listen now to Barbara Lewis, who was on the programme last week, talking about Palestine, because this was it's bugging me, because this was an issue which should really have been included in the foreign policy debate, which was held in Bristol last week, but Palestine and that whole problem wasn't even touched on. Anyway, Barbara Lewis last week accused Ed Hill, who's a Palestine campaigner, and you'll hear her now, exactly what she said, and let's have a listen to Ed afterwards and see if you two agree with either, both, or neither. What about the Palestine issue, Tess? Because that didn't feature at all in the so-called foreign policy debate that was had last night between the three main party leaders.
No, I have to say I agree with Ed Hill. And this is a very important issue that I think a lot of British people think strongly about, and they want much more effort made to actually bring peace to that part of the world. And the current government is not doing anything like enough.
So you would agree with Ed Hill then that Israel should not exist? Because that's what he was saying on the broadcast.
Well, that was Barbara Lewis from the Conservatives talking last week on the programme. And I just thought we'd like to give Ed Hill another try so we can see what he actually said and whether he was saying that Israel couldn't exist.
Look, I think it's an absolute disgrace. You know, we've got three politicians, one of them will, I presumably, form the next government, and they all want to keep off the real agenda, which is the unjustified and illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And for me, as you know, I'm passionate about the Palestinian cause. 62 years the Palestinians have been dispossessed of their land by the formation of Israel, backed by Britain, backed by the United States. They all desperately want to keep off that subject. And to me, support for Israel seems to be part of the DNA of the British government, whichever party is in control.
Okay, Mark, for Labour, would you like to just respond to that whole Palestine issue? Where does the Labour Party and you personally stand on this?
Well, the Labour Party and my personal view is that you will not get lasting peace in the Middle East until there's a two-state solution, so that you have a secure, viable Israel and you have a secure, viable Palestinian state. And all the international agreements have you know, said that that is the case. And the international community, I believe, is working hard to actually achieve this. But it's also important that Israel shows restraint when it reacts to what it perceives to be threats, real or indeed otherwise, and that the Palestinian Authority, which I know is a fragile entity, does more to rein in the more extreme people within Palestine who seem to want to provoke Israel and the international community to react. But I believe, and the Labour Party believes very clearly, that a two-state solution is the outcome that we all want. I know President Obama is working very hard for this purpose. I know Gordon Brown is as well.
Mike, so where do you stand on this the Palestine issue?
Well, Palestine exists, Israel exists. It's not for me to say they should or should not, but there are two countries in existence and both warring against each other. It's clear that they won't solve their problems alone. We need some independent body to perhaps apply an umbrella governance arrangement over them, such as the United Nations, to work hard to minimise any of these things that happen between them that cause weapons to be used, and try and create a pause, if you like, over several years, so that they can start to accept their differences, work to resolve them, and basically stop injuring both sides.
Thanks. Now, let's have a listen to one of the classic exchanges, at least in my mind anyway, of the campaign so far, which was on Victoria Derbyshire's Five Live phone-in last week. It was between the BMP's Simon Darby and a local Luton church worker.
It's very difficult. I mean, we can take on the political parties, but when we take on most of the media, the church, the trades unions,
the
various
church?
Methodist groups...
Then, how dare you speak for the church?
You see what I mean? It's
how dare you speak for the church?
It's difficult.
Yes, sir. Introduce yourself, sir.
I'm Peter Adams. I live in Luton.
I work with the churches and all the faith communities of this town. I fundamentally reject the arrogant, disruptive presence that the BNP has been in this town in the last year. You and people like you have stirred up this community.
Don't shoot the
have taken the sense of displacement that so many in this town feel, legitimately white people, indigenous English as you call them, and yet you have stirred them up, you and those like you, to an anger that has disrupted
our town. You're the angry one. Not me.
You call yourself indigenous English. I am indigenous English. You call yourself... Well, the BNP claims to speak for the church. It does not.
The
church wants to bring peace and harmony in this town and this nation.
Are you going to let me respond to that outburst?
Well, fiery stuff there on Five Live last week and a Victoria Derbyshire programme. That was the BNP Simon Darby and a local Luton church worker. What's your attitude to the BNP, Mark, for Labour?
Very clear on the BNP. I think that they are a organisation, a political party focused on race. They're preoccupied with race. Their mission is to stir up fear and anxiety. They have no policies beyond this. You know, you try and engage the BNP. I have in my own ward where I have a BNP candidate who is standing against me. You engage in about education and health and crime and transport, and they have no policies. They're focused on race. They're focused on provoking hate. You know, I welcome the fact that they're taking part in these elections, because it's an opportunity for people to really understand what they're about and what they stand for. And, you know, I will certainly do all that I can, you know, whether I'm on the council or not, to fight against what they actually stand for, which I believe is just hatred.
And Mike, what about you and the Lib Dems?
Well, last August, I started doing some fairly intensive canvassing in Bristol East, as it happens, and I met quite a large number of people who actually felt cut off and ignored from politicians. And it's those situations that worry me, and it's that fundamentally which allows a gap to emerge where people like the BNP become live and active. The solution is very simple. When they are challenged by the major parties, they are beaten, and that's what all three major parties must do. They must challenge them and beat them at the ballot box.
But what about this idea that the British people, who apparently this Simon Darby was saying that there are English families who've been here since the Ice Age, and that they are not really represented by the main parties?
I think it's quite an absurd argument, actually, because Britain has always been a trading nation. It is an island country. We've had waves of immigration and migration over the years, both people actually leaving the country, you know, to go to America and New Zealand, Australia and Canada and a whole host of other places, and people coming to this country over the centuries. I think it adds to our vitality as a country that we do have a mixture. This bizarre notion that the BNP has, that there's a group of people in the country whose DNA proves that they are pure British, going back to the Ice Age or whatever, it's just ludicrous.
So absolutely ludicrous. Mike, is your family a British family from the Ice Age, has been here that long?
I don't know. I can go back to 1580 with my family history. After that, I ran out of energy, I'm afraid.
Okay, so... let's have a look at some of this week's news stories now. We've been through that lot. And we're going to start with the church revealed an Oxford graduate who sent an offensive memo about the Pope will keep his job as a civil servant. Oxford graduate who sent a seriously offensive email suggesting the Pope should open an abortion clinic ahead of the Pontiff's visit to Britain will keep his job in the civil service. It emerged today. Now, Mark, can you start with this one? Do you think that this guy should have kept his job, or do you think it was just a joke that went wrong, or was it actually a funny? What do you think?
I think politicians need to be careful when they call for sackings of civil servants, because the civil service has its own rules for discipline. I think that the fact that this memo was drafted, even that somebody was thinking these absurd things, is just completely and utterly mad. I know the Foreign Secretary said it is very, in very clear terms, that this is offensive, it's something that shouldn't have been done. I believe the civil service has disciplined this particular individual and he or she has been moved to other duties. Whatever your views about the Catholic Church, whatever your views about the Pope, you know, he is a foreign head of state due to visit the country, and you know, he should be shown the same status as other heads of state. You know, whatever your views about the Church, whatever your views about the Pope and the Catholic Church in particular.
Is it appropriate, do you think, for someone who's a civil servant being paid out of the public purse to be talking about getting the Pope to launch a range of Benedict condoms, apologising for the Spanish Armada and blessing a gay marriage?
No, I don't. I think it's absurd. And, I would hope that civil servants at all levels spend their time on more productive, important things. You know, this is clearly, you know, what may have been a jokey conversation down at the pub being transferred into our briefing note. And I think it was wrong, and the guy concerned has been disciplined, and the government has said absolutely that it did something that shouldn't have happened.
The Vatican aren't cancelling the visit, but they are talking about dark forces within the British government. What's your view on this story, Mike?
Well, certainly I wouldn't disagree with the existence of dark forces, I guess there's one of two issues, really. Did someone authorise a release of this, or was it leaked?
It sounds like it was leaked, I think. Yeah, it was an internal memo that was leaked.
In that case, what level of supervision was being applied to people doing work? Was that work authorised? They most certainly, in my view, were not gainfully employed. And it's a matter of discipline, I'm afraid, that needs to be applied in this case.
OK, our next story, Albury nuclear expansion and your safety, the risk to the people of Gloucestershire. This is a report which is just out yesterday, commissioned by Martin Whiteside, who's a Green Party parliamentary candidate for Stroud. Now, it talks about the dangers in the region of nuclear expansion, talking about possibility of cancer clusters, looking at the legacy of nuclear waste, how difficult it is to clear up afterwards, the risk of catastrophe, the fact that you've got such a this dangerous material there, and also they actually argue that it will lead to a reduction of jobs. So what are your thoughts about the possible expansion of Albury Power Station and the others in the region?
We have a gap in our energy security. I think by about 2018 we face major shortages in terms of our own electricity supply in the country. Even if we have a very accelerated programme of wind turbines and wave power and all the other things that the government wants to do and has begun to do, still won't be enough to close the gap. So nuclear is required. The existing nuclear capacity will be outdated by then. However, it's important that people are reassured independently about their safety issues and safety concerns. But looking at what other countries have done, the only real way you can close the energy gap and reduce our dependency on oil and on carbon is to invest in nuclear, but in a very safe way.
Well, this doesn't sound very safe. I mean, they're talking about cancer clusters and all sorts of things here.
And I would hope that the points that he's raised, I don't know if it's an independent piece of work or what, but it's important that those are assessed and understood, and that somebody within government or within the independent nuclear agency, I can't remember what it's called now, comes back and deals with each of these points in turn. And it has to be safe, but obviously we face a major issue in this country in terms of energy supply. If we're to reduce our dependency on oil, if we're to close this electricity gap, which will be on us in not so long into the future, we've got to find something new, and nuclear seems to fit that bill.
Mike, what about the Lib Dems?
Well, we are against any new nuclear build. The travesty in all this is that you've now got the two old parties, Labour and the Tories, painting themselves green, trying to make themselves look modern and up-to-date, environmentalists and all that sort of stuff. 17 years ago, I'm sure there are some pretty decent papers around about how to transform from nuclear power to sustainable sources. So the only reason it's a big debate today is because the two older parties have been lax in preparing the country for a far cleaner form of energy.
Mark, do you want to come back there?
I think even if you have the most fantastic programme of wind turbine building, both onshore and offshore, and we know that Tory councils across the country have been opposing wind turbines. You know, for the Tories in particular to claim they're green is a bit absurd when Tory councils try and block these schemes. Even if you have things like a Severn barrage, I know that there are concerns about the barrage, but different technologies may do the trick. Even if you do all that, you still have a major gap in our energy supply not so long into the future. We've got to do something about it if we're to reduce our dependency on oil and to have control over our own energy supply. And nuclear at the moment, looking at what other countries have done, looking at what we've done in the past, seems to be the most viable, sensible option, but in a safe way.
There's a lot of coal still under the hills in South Wales.
There's a lot of coal, but if you burn coal, you add to carbon emissions, even with the latest technology to actually make it safe and clean, you still add to carbon. So it's about addressing our dependency on oil, reducing carbon emissions, but making sure we have clean and safe energy into the future. That's what the country needs. We can't bury our head in the sand, I'm afraid, because, as I say, by about 2018, we start facing major problems as a country.
Well, Mike, what about that? Because we don't want the lights going out. If you're not going to have any nuclear power, how are you going to generate enough electricity for the country?
We could have been working years ago to make buildings more efficient, to start to minimise our dependence on electricity through efficiency measures that are all around us today. We've just been too late in policy terms, and I think this government and the previous one, the Tories, have been off the pace.
Okay, we're going to be talking about some of the local hot election stories in a moment, but first I think we're going to have a little bit of music from Stevie Wonder.
Was
from Songs in the Key of Life. Stevie Wonder with I Wish. Now, welcome back to Friday Drive Time. Joining me in the studio is Mark Bradshaw, Deputy Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, and Mike Popham, who's prospective parliamentary candidate in Bristol East, for the Lib Dems. And we're having a look at another news story from this week, this time very much an election one. The postal voters have been sent the wrong ballot papers in Bristol West. Thousands of postal voters in the parliamentary constituency of Bristol West received papers intended for people in Bristol East. All 2,378 affected voters have been sent a letter from Bristol Council's electoral services. Council chiefs advised people to tear up the incorrect ballot papers and said replacements would be sent out soon. Mark, maybe you can help us on this one. Have those been sent out yet, do you know?
I have no idea because my ward isn't one of those affected. What I would like to say, though, is I just find this amazing in that we've all known about the boundary changes for some time now, and I don't know whether it's a human error or whether it's a software issue or what, but it does seem to be quite amazing that this has actually happened.
So who's responsible for this?
Well, I don't know. I suspect it's the City Council, but I don't know if it's a decision made by a particular individual, whether it's a computer glitch or what.
But at the end of the day, surely the buck stops with the returning officer. He's supposed to manage these elections.
Well, I presume so. What my concern is that obviously a lot more people now use postal votes because they're convenient and a secure way of actually registering your vote if you're going to be away or if you're not sure if you're going to be here on polling day. And this, I think, you know, does dent some of the confidence in the postal vote system, which I think is unfortunate. So I think we've all got to work very hard to reassure people that it is still a valid and safe way to vote, and that the council has to work hard to put right what seems to be a bit of a mess up.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, what strikes me is, look, you've got a lot of elderly people who use postal votes anyway, and maybe they haven't been watching the TV, listening to the radio avidly. They may just fill these the wrong forms out and send them in as their vote, mightn't they? Mike, what do you think about this? Because, you know, you must have some intel on what's been going on and whether this has been put to rights and how it happened in the first place.
Well, if it was a software problem, that should be no excuse. All actions should be supervised and managed. I've got to say, I feel for the officials responsible because they work, you know, flat out on this sort of stuff. But even so, human error should have been covered by management. Where is the supervision? Where is the checking? Couldn't have been there in this case.
One of the things I read about this was also that this is a service which, in its wisdom, the council officers have decided to, or council as well, have decided to farm out to a private company. Now, is it appropriate to be getting private companies to be managing our elections? Mark, you first.
Well, I'm not currently a member of the Cabinet, so I don't know what decisions have been taken to privatise it or indeed not. But I think, you know, we have known about these boundary changes for some time, at least a couple of years. You know, surely someone somewhere said, well, what do we have to do that once there is an election called, let's do a test run, let's see where we need to make adjustments. Now, for this to happen, you know, a week or two before polling day is just amazing, absolutely amazing. You know, this is the City Council is a major organisation, 18,000 employees, lots of very well paid, very, very experienced individuals working for it. For them not to get this right is pretty fundamental. And I accept what Mike says, a lot of very hard working, very diligent people working for the council. But that's no excuse, really. This just shouldn't have happened.
Mike, what about this idea that possibly elderly people who have taken postal votes may think this is the correct ballot paper, haven't seen it on the news, and just posted off anyway?
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm not sure we can do anything about that. But this issue of using private companies, that does not resolve the council of responsibility for what those private companies do. It comes back to supervision again. If the attitude is farm it off to the private sector and leave it hands off without checking is not good enough. There's no excuses here. This was a bad affair. Shouldn't happen again. But we need to look at management, how it was managed, whether there are sufficient resources in place.
And as someone who's on the cabinet yourself, is this something that's come up over the last year or so, the idea of using private companies to do these postal ballots for the council?
No, there's been no change in policy over how we commission our resources, in that respect anyway. I think politicians, busy as they are, would have expected such a well-oiled process to have been properly thought through, managed through, supervised through, and executed properly. It hasn't in this case.
As someone who's on the cabinet, I mean, to what extent are officers, like the returning officer, for example, given their autonomy, and to what extent do you know everything about what they're doing? So, you know, it's, I'm trying to wonder what the balance is between when you have to call decisions in to cabinet rather than just let officers get on with it, like possibly in this case.
Well, in this case, it's a thing that you look to your officials to know exactly what to do, how to do it, when to do it, at what speed it's done. It's, you know, a part of democracy. We don't, as politicians, we don't supervise, nor do we manage, actually. There's a full enterprise of officials from service directors down. So in amongst that lot lies the problem.
And have you made any decisions to have an investigation into what's happened here?
Oh, I'm sure we will.
Okay, well, let us know when you find out. Another big election story, which is just literally yesterday. This is from the BBC website. Labour MP, well, she's not an MP, she's a candidate again now, Kerry McCarthy for Bristol East, who you're standing against, Mike, was appointed Twitter czar to boost online use. But Labour's new media czar has been reported to the police yesterday for an alleged breach of electoral rules after tweeting about postal votes. Kerry McCarthy was reported to the police by Bristol City Council. The alleged breach is over failure to keep postal votes secret. So apparently these postal vote results are given out to a small coterie of people beforehand. Is that right? Because it looks like she's just then put those results onto Twitter. Mark, well, how has this happened?
Well, I can't comment on this particular case because I understand that there is an investigation underway. But all candidates or the candidates' agents have the right to be in the same room when the postal votes are indeed opened and checked. But it is under a confidentiality agreement. And, you know, that's my comment on this. I think on a wider point about Twitter, I use Twitter because I find it a useful way to communicate with people in my own ward and across the city. And it is an invaluable way to share information and talk about issues. And if you want politicians to engage in that way, you know, whether it's through Facebook or through Twitter or through blogs, there's always going to be a risk. There's a risk for the person, you know, who is putting information on Twitter, and there's a risk that it may be misinterpreted or misunderstood by the person reading it. So I think that there's a wider issue about openness, and if we as politicians are to be expected to be on Twitter, Facebook and all these other media, you know, from time to time, you know, we may do or say something that is misinterpreted or misunderstood. But that's my comment on this. I can't really comment on this particular case because there is an ongoing investigation, I understand.
Okay, Mike, what are your thoughts about what Kerry's apparently done here?
Well, apparently there has been a breach of the rules. That's now in the hands of the Electoral Commission and the police. I think we should say no more about it than that, other than to allow due process to be carried out.
Okay, but it strikes me that we've just had two stories that are very much related. We've had the postal ballots from Kerry's constituency, which have been messed up. And then when we have a postal count behind the scenes, I wonder if these votes have all been got in. Because what are they doing? Partial counts of the postal vote before the end, before the day is just in the run-up to the election, or what?
I think what you have every day is you have the postal votes being opened and then sorted into the general election votes and the local election votes. And as I say, candidates or the candidates' agents can actually attend to view that process, but not take part in it, of course, you know, not to touch the ballots or to interfere with the ballots, just to be in the room to supervise the process. But it is under a very clear confidentiality arrangement that you do not disclose that information. And that is something that all candidates, you know, are made aware of.
So all the parties and candidates are able to scrutinise the entire electoral process, really, right from the start, right to the end of the count.
Yes, but not to interfere in the process, not to touch the ballots in any way, but to ensure that the process is being undertaken in the correct manner.
Okay, well, let's hope that there's no more mess-ups with the postal votes here in Bristol. Anyway, next story. Think you could do better? Peter Hargreaves, senior Conservative and Bristol's former mayor, throws down the gauntlet. Early this week in the Bristol Evening Post, we had a message, really, from a retiring senior businessman in the city, Peter Hargreaves, who was saying, as a councillor, and this is actually a riposte from Peter Abraham, senior Conservative councillor, says, as a councillor, I find it incredibly insulting that someone to come along and label us as idiots, Mr. Abraham says. My challenge to Mr. Hargreaves is to come and stand for election and see if he can do a better job than the politicians. Well, what do you think about being called an idiot by this businessman, Peter Hargreaves, Mark?
Well, I'm not very impressed. I actually respect Peter Hargreaves for what he's achieved and the business that he and Steve Lansdowne have actually built up, because it employs a lot of people in the city and is important for Bristol's economy. But
for
people
that don't know, can you tell us about the business?
It's Hargreaves Lansdowne, which is a stockbroking insurance advisory company, one of the biggest in the country, but was built up by Peter Hargreaves and Steve Lansdowne from scratch. And I respect anybody who has that degree of enterprise and, you know, important players in the city of Bristol and in the economy. But I do think he's gone too far. You know, I'm a politician. I'm used to being called all sorts of things. I've got a relatively thick skin. I'm sure Mike's the same. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, his comments don't do anything to instill confidence in the city. What the damage is, I think, and I know the chief executive has made comments along these lines. You know, I used to have the economic development portfolio. A lot of my time was spent encouraging people to invest in Bristol to bring jobs and employment and skills here. I think the comment which have been reported to have been made by Peter Hargreaves do somewhat undermine that.
Okay,
I think that's unfortunate.
Mike, what are your thoughts about Peter Hargreaves' comments?
Actually, I mean, I had 20 years in the Air Force, and that has a culture of its own, different to the public sector generally, and most certainly different to business. And the transition that I had to go through from a military environment to the civil business one was challenging, I've got to say. I'm actually more surprised at the reaction of Councillor Abrams, really. He should know that we depend on people like Peter and Steve to help the city as an enterprising entity, and we're very, very grateful to them. We should continue to say to them, we are very grateful to you. I'm sure that that Peter and Steve were probably trying to cause something to happen for the good of the city. Maybe we're frustrated by the relationship between business thinking and public sector thinking.
Well, what do you think about Councillor Abraham's challenge, saying to Peter Hargreaves, come and stand for election, see if you can do a better job than us?
No, I think we should sit down over a beer or a cup of tea and actually chat through what it's really like, and wouldn't want to waste the time, frankly. Get on and do what you're good at, Steve and Peter, and help the city make some more money.
Well, it's interesting that Peter makes the challenge when the nominations have actually closed for the local elections. So if Peter Hargreaves wants to stand in 2011, obviously he can. But I do think that there is perhaps a wider issue here, is that, you know, a lot of people in the city are still, you know, not convinced that the city council is actually working for them. They pay a lot of council tax, and sometimes they don't feel that the services are actually there. And I think across party, all councillors have a job to do to actually, you know, make sure the council is more responsive to the needs of the people in the city who, after all, pay the council tax.
Absolutely.
You know, it is expensive. You know, it is over £1,000 for most people in the city, and they expect a better service.
Well, let's just sum up this man's amazing career. He's the financial guru, he's referred to here in the Evening Post. He's one of the richest men in the country and has amassed a personal fortune of £570 million, thanks to the incredible success of the company he set up with his business partner and current Bristol City Chairman, Stephen Lansdowne, 29 years ago. Anyway, let's have a look at one of our last stories today, and this is a fury as up to 300 urns containing human remains from Dignitas Suicide Clinic are found at the bottom of Lake Zurich. Mike, do you want to start on this one? What are your thoughts on this assisted suicide generally, and this company, Dignitas, in particular?
Crikey. Yeah, well, if we deal with the human remains being dumped like this, I mean, it's a travesty. It's just awful. They should be, examined and dealt with within the law.
But what about the general issue of this whole business, which we've heard about over the last year or so, of assisted suicide? Do you think it's still something that is a really important right for people to commit suicide in this assisted fashion?
I'm sure there will be cases where there is a case for it. But if it's to happen, I think it should be done with objective supervision. Within the law, assessed by lawyers, and also probably the family too.
Because there's actually quite a lot of pressure on people financially, and sometimes there may be a financial motive involved.
Well, I don't think that's any reason for assisted suicide.
Okay, Mark, what about your thoughts on this story specifically, 300 urns containing human remains found at the bottom of Lake Zurich and the general principle?
Well, on the general principle, Tony, I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of assisted suicide because of the potential for, indeed, abuse, and you've mentioned the financial motive. But quite clearly, a lot of people face a major dilemma in their lives, looking after a loved one and knowing that somebody's suffering from a terminal illness, perhaps with a great deal of pain, and feeling that they've got to do something, that they've got to help, their loved one bring it to an end. But it does fit very uncomfortably with the legal process that we currently have, and I feel for the people who are faced with this problem. It is a real, it's a real tragedy. In terms of this particular company and the allegations that have been made, I agree with Mike, it's got to be properly investigated. I think that this also, adds to my concern about the general principle that there are, commercial entities, commercial organisations who are perhaps waiting to take advantage of people who are at their most fragile. And that for me is a big worry. And I think, what's being reported here is an example of that. That you've got commercial entities that are only too willing to take advantage of people, maybe, who are at their most fragile and their most exposed.
That was Mark Bradshaw, Deputy Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, and he is standing in the forthcoming election as a local candidate in Bedminster. And I'll just read through the other candidates that are also standing with Mark. So Mark is standing for the Labour and Cooperative Party. Ian Robert Cooper is standing for the Liberal Democrats. Doug Newton is standing for the Conservative Party. Pip Shord is standing for is an independent. Kath Slade for the Green Party. And William George Taylor for the British National Party. And Mike Popham, our Lib Dem friend who's been with us here, he's standing as a prospective parliamentary candidate in the Bristol East constituency. And the other candidates there are Philip John Collins for the UK Independence Party, Brian Trevor Jenkins for the British National Party, Ray Lynch for the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, Kerry McCarthy for the Labour Party, Adela Shafi for the Conservative Party, and Glenn Vowles for the Green Party. Not to forget, Stephen Martin Wright for the English Democrats, putting people first. And that's it. Thank you very much, you two, for coming in here. That's Mark Bradshaw for Labour and Mike Popham for the Lib Dems.
Thanks, Tony.
Now, after the news, Bristol's leadership debate last week. Why was audience involvement kept to a bare minimum? After all, as Brown, Clegg and Cameron kept telling us, we run the show. But do we? We redress the balance a little bit after the 6 o'clock news as we hear a bit from some of the questioners. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here and he'll be delving into the murky world of computerised stock dealing software, how a computer programme designed to save the free market turned into a monster. And we'll be looking at the investment bank Goldman Sachs, also known, of course, as Goldmine Sachs, and the Greek financial crisis. What exactly is going on, and could the Greek financial crisis bring down the euro? Plus, BCFM's arts correspondent Billy Quain will be here with his top tips for when you've switched off your television, where to most productively loiter over the next week. So Do please join us after the news. My name's Tony Gosling, BCFM Friday Drive Time, and my guests in the first hour were Mike Popham, who's a Lib Dem candidate in the general election, and Mark Bradshaw, who's a Labour candidate in the local elections. Join us after the news.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.